Welcome to MetaStrategy's Forum on World-Class IT, a weekly conversation with people who are shaping the technology landscape. I'm Peter High, and I'm pleased to welcome Mike Keller to the broadcast. Mike Keller is Executive Vice President and Chief Information Officer of Nationwide, a $43 billion insurance and financial services company. He's responsible for the prioritization and delivery of Nationwide's strategic business transformation program, technology strategy, and IT capabilities. Prior to joining Nationwide in 2001, Mike was Chief Technology Officer for Corporate Infrastructure at Bank One and held leadership roles at IBM in a number of areas, including global services and industry solutions. Mike earned a bachelor's degree in mathematics from the University of Michigan. I recently caught up with Mike in his office in Columbus, Ohio, and our conversation covered world-class IT Principle 1, people, as Mike discussed how he recruits, develops, and transitions talent in an evolving organization. Principle 4, IT and business partnerships, as Mike discussed his team's role in Nationwide's ongoing transformation. And Principle 5, external partnerships, as Mike described Nationwide's relationship with its three global services providers. We also covered Mike's long tenure as CIO of Nationwide and a variety of other topics. If you like what you hear, we'd be grateful if you'd give us a rating on iTunes or through whatever other source you use for podcasts. Thank you. This is Peter High. Please consider reading my new book, Implementing World-Class IT Strategy, How IT Can Drive Organizational Innovation. The book covers topics such as the CIO as strategic facilitator, the development of IT missions, facilitating corporate and divisional strategy, the development of IT's own strategic plans, the development of enterprise architecture, reviewing, refreshing, and communicating strategy, and several other topics, all told with stories from leading CIOs from a variety of major corporations. You can find it at Amazon.com, my publisher's website, Wiley.com, and at your better bookstores. Thank you very much. Mike Keller, welcome to the Forum on World-Class IT.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Wonderful. So, Mike, I thought we'd begin with your purview as Chief Information Officer of Nationwide. Can you take a moment to describe your responsibilities and maybe take a brief moment to talk about some of the diverse array of experiences and responsibilities you've had in roles prior to CIO?
I began my career with IBM and spent most of my time in customer-facing roles, including my final job there was running a P&L in their global services area, but mostly focused around technology-oriented consulting and systems integration. I spent a lot of time in the automotive industry. And then after IBM, I went to Bank One. I was the chief technology officer for their technology infrastructure, and then been at Nationwide as CIO since 2001. And during that time, have run sourcing and procurement and internet and a few other things, but we've gone to a pretty pure functional organizational alignment. So I run the IT operation, which is about a $1.3 billion a year in expense operation, over 5,000 associates, over 3,000 contractors. So pretty large scale in traditional areas like application development, application maintenance, infrastructure and operations.
And can you take a moment to talk a bit about some of the items on your current strategic roadmap?
From a business standpoint, we've been in insurance and financial services with a core mission of helping to protect consumers and businesses and help them build a secure financial future. So the core mission of the company has been stable. But several years ago, we spent time looking at what do we need to look like in 2020 and beyond. While our typical strategic planning horizon is 3 years, we took a 6+ year look and decided to make some pretty fundamental changes to the company. A lot of it we talk about under the slogan, one company, one brand. Nationwide historically ran a lot of its businesses with a fair degree of independence and autonomy, and we grew partially through acquisitions, and in a lot of cases had left those companies and their brands and products intact. So it's a pretty big shift to take all of Nationwide and put it all under a common brand. And then while the branding work itself, I mean, just things from building signage to websites to forms and printing output, while there was a fair amount of work even at the superficial level, the one company part of that strategy really represents a major set of changes. And if you look at a portfolio of strategic initiatives we have, we call them Tier 1 Business Transformation Program. An awful lot of those things are around bringing us together as one company and simplifying products, processes, and technologies.
Very interesting. And I know that you're perhaps in concert with some of the changes that you've described. You've been undergoing a strategic business transformation and you've helped usher that in. Can you talk a bit more about IT's role in that and how you and the company more generally sees technology as part of the glue, bringing together a one company, one brand mentality and mission?
I'll start with a governance perspective. We created quite a few years ago, I think it was in 2007 or 8, a business transformation and technology committee of the board of directors. We were beginning to make some of these large bets on business transformation, and almost all of them have a very high technology component to them. So we created a board committee to help prioritize and oversee those large-scale technology investments. We created a committee within the management team made up of the business unit heads, the head of marketing, finance, and IT. That management committee basically sets the priorities, funding, and oversees the delivery of these large transformational programs. So just to give you a perspective, when I talk about the transformational programs, in most cases, we are simplifying and modernizing the business and basically redoing our core systems at the same time. I'll give you one example. So we're probably best known for personal lines insurance, auto insurance, homeowners insurance, and the like. Prior to the one company, one brand strategy that we're on, we went to market as Nationwide Insurance, Harleysville Insurance, Allied Insurance, Titan Insurance. And in addition to having those four different brands, because they grew up as four independent companies, you had a whole suite of products from auto to home to umbrella to boats, motorcycles. And then the different companies went to market through different distribution channels. So we have exclusive agents, independent agents, and a direct operation. And each of those companies had come up with their own products. And so the legal construct and things like insurance coverages and policy limitations and those kinds of things were different across the company. So we embarked on personal lines transformation as one of our large transformational programs. And we're moving to a single suite of products that will have the same legal constructs, the same underwriting and pricing constructs across all the companies. They're all going to be branded Nationwide and will have omni-channel capabilities supporting, again, exclusive agents, independent agents, direct phone, direct internet. It's a large scale change, as you can imagine, affecting almost every part of that business. As a part of that, though, each of those companies that formed our history had their own suite of systems. Most of them were older systems. So we replaced essentially all of those personal line systems from those independent companies onto off-the-shelf package from a company called Guidewire. It is pretty much a complete overhaul of the products, business processes, and the technology, that five-year, approaching $500 million type investment. And we believe that it'll make our business a lot more efficient. We think it'll allow us to deliver a better customer experience, and it'll give us a lot of speed and agility in a lot of areas, including IT. And while that's one example, we have similar strategies in place and similar large-scale programs in place for our commercial lines, property and casualty, claims, our retirement plan business, our life insurance business, and our bank. So to have that many large transformational programs going on all at the same time, exciting times for us. We're at different stages and different elements of the program, but you know, we're spending over $500 million a year for an extended number of years to basically simplify and modernize and reinvent almost all of our core businesses.
To what extent has this been an opportunity to leverage cloud technologies and other sorts of, you mentioned modernization, so it goes without speaking that you're seeking out more modern technology to leverage. I can imagine that can be a difficult set of undertakings, though, taking a traditional, in many cases, probably long-standing infrastructure and modernizing it to a greater extent. I'm sure you can't go into all the details in the time that we have allocated, but can you talk a bit about the way in which you think about managing such a large transformation, going from the more traditional IT infrastructure, IT technology, to a more modern footprint?
A lot of the insurance businesses that we're in, historically for a large carrier, there weren't off-the-shelf packages that couldn't meet the need. So you see in insurance more than you do in a lot of other industries. Like if I mentioned to you that I used to work a lot with the automotive industry. So if you look at manufacturing with a wave of ERP solutions like an SAP, we didn't have that type of system available. So we have a higher degree of historical legacy, internally developed or roll your own system than probably what you'd find in a lot of businesses. For a lot of the corporate functions, HR, finance, and the like, that wasn't the case. So we had a lot of packages in those areas, and we are increasingly moving those to software as a service model. For example, we're just kicking off a project to put Workday in for our human resources systems, moving off of PeopleSoft. We've moved off legacy packages in IT to things like ServiceNow, CRM off of older products like Siebel into Salesforce. So a fair amount of SaaS work going on in the corporate functions. In the core business areas for both personal lines and commercial lines policy administration, think of those as kind of the big ERP engines for our two big property and casualty business. And then also for claims, we are going with a company called Guidewire. It is a very modern package. They are in the process of getting it to the point where it is, you know, ready to run in the cloud, but it was not cloud native. We have similar situations in our life insurance business. We're moving to Oracle's insurance platform. There were a couple of cases, like in our retirement plans business, where we couldn't find anything in the market, and so we had to do custom development. Long and short of it, our preference is SaaS first, package second, custom develop third, but just based on the state of the market, we have a combination of all of those in play.
And is there a difference in the sorts of people you now seek to fill your team? You mentioned you have a massive team, especially when you can count the contractors. And if you think about where technology was compared to where it's going, I can only imagine that at least some of the skills need to change. And I'd be curious about the way in which you thought about that as well.
We've done a lot of work in the area of what we call workforce planning, so part of our broader delivery model, a focus on people, talent, profession dimension is an important consideration. We started looking several years ago at the big technology trends. I've talked a lot about our legacy replacements, but when you look at data and cyber and mobile and all of the other big trends, it was very clear to us that the size and mix of skills in our workforce was going to change pretty dramatically. And we actually spent time, we went out and visited a number of different technology companies, did a West Coast swing and an East Coast swing. We talked to a bunch of outside consultants because we figured there had to be a lot of IT organizations that, if they looked 5 years out, were going to need a very different workforce. And what we found was there wasn't a lot of maturity or consistency in the way the world went about it. A surprising number of people seem to be in the model of, if I need it today, I'll hire it, and if I don't need it anymore, I'll lay it off kind of thing. What we've tried to do is multi-year workforce planning, trying to figure out how many people we're going to need with what skill sets, and we've looked at internal to external ratios, we've looked at historical attrition, and basically built a workforce planning model that allows us to anticipate what we're going to need down the road, and then try to put the things in place that we need to do to both recruit and develop to where we think we need to be in the future. So that's kind of at the enterprise level, we've done that planning, and then in each of the areas where these programs are going on, we do much more detailed planning. Take, for example, that personal lines one that I talked about before. We have a situation where we're still supporting all of those legacy systems. We're doing a massive program to both build out and configure the Guidewire platform and do all of the integration and data work required to convert. So we have a very large program team. We have the legacy support teams, and then we're building out the run support organization that we'll need when we're all in on the new platform. During that bubble, we have much higher numbers than what we will ultimately need, and we'll need a different skill set. We've tried to give our workforce as much of an option as possible. We've had a lot of people that liked that part of the business and were willing to learn new technologies, and so we've helped migrate them to learn Guidewire instead of COBOL as an example. We have other people who really wanted to stay in the technology domain that they were in. Maybe they're close to retirement or want to go about those, and we've tried to help them land other internal jobs within. We've leveraged suppliers, both at the consulting and at the systems integration level, to try to help with that transition. Long and short of it, we will end up with a workforce in a lot of these areas that's substantially smaller, in some cases half the size of what we started with, and the skills that we will need will be different. Given that a lot of these are multi-year journeys, taken the time to really plan and try to help our associates through it and make sure that from a company standpoint, we have the right numbers of the right skills at the right time. And from an associate standpoint, tried wherever possible to help people maintain their career here and migrate their skills.
No, that's excellent. I'm also curious, clearly, just given the number of vendors that you're engaging, whether it's staff augmentation vendors, you mentioned a number of the premier cloud vendors that you're engaging as well. How have you thought about vendor governance? I have to imagine that's become a more prominent piece as you increase the scale and reliance on partnerships outside of the company as well. Can you talk a bit about that evolution?
First, I would say we have very good partnership with our sourcing and procurement organization, and we have joint teams of technology leaders and our sourcing partners looking at what we ought to do across pretty much all of the areas that you would think. So whether it's traditional infrastructure, telecom or compute or storage, whether it's cloud and kind of infrastructure or platform as a service space or the SaaS space in the consulting and services space. So we've done a lot of work with them and really tried to rationalize the supply base as much as we can. And this was actually one of the things we did not only to support the implementation of all of these large programs, but also to try to drive efficiency. So we have selected three what we call global service providers. So these are folks where we have both onshore and offshore development, integration, and maintenance work going on. And, you know, we have good partnerships with all three, I think healthy competition amongst them, and we're getting, you know, substantially better service levels at better costs, and, you know, have evolved our thinking and our maturity around what kind of contracting vehicle makes the most sense. So, you know, when should it be, you know, kind of statement of work project based? When should it be a managed service? When should it be staff augmentation? So we've rationalized the global suppliers. We've also rationalized and reduced our local supply base a lot. And we have a governance team in place that I think is getting the right skills and resources, the right quality outcomes at lower costs than we've had in the past. It's a complicated topic. What we do in the cloud space is a little different than what I just talked about, which is more on the service side. But I would just say that pretty happy with where we're at and pretty proud of the partnerships that we've developed. We have had folks in here who I think have been integral to our success. I think our track record for delivering on large complex programs is quite a bit above where the industry is. And to do that while we have this many going on at the same time, I don't think we could do without the help of some really strong partners.
That's great. I wonder, what role does your team play in customer-facing technology? And also, I guess, a related question, to what extent does the IT team have contact with customers to glean from them their sort of needs or impressions when it comes to use of technology?
It's a great question. We've created a delivery model, as we call it, but it's our business model for how we do IT within Nationwide that I'm pretty proud of and that I think is working pretty well. Part of that is to make sure that we have both organizational structure and governance that really optimizes for both business intimacy and economies of scale. In my experience, historically, a lot of companies will go with a pretty decentralized approach in order to get business intimacy, but then they don't really leverage their economies of scale, don't have consistent standards, have real challenges in areas like data and security and others, but they're closer to the business. A lot of the companies that go with a highly centralized model end up with good standards, good economies of scale, but a view that they're not connected to the business. We've come up with a model where we keep plan, build, and run accountability in groups that are very close to the businesses, wherever possible, co-located with them, gone almost exclusively to agile development practices. I would say my teams are very close to both their business partners and the end user of the technology, which could be agents or distribution partners, or could be consumers directly. And then increasingly, wherever we can, the strategy of modernizing and simplifying the core business and the core systems of record then puts you in a position where you can do work in the data space or the digital space that allows you to be much quicker and to create the kind of digital experiences that we want to have facing both our end customers and our distribution partners.
Excellent. I also wanted to ask you, you've had as you pointed out at the outset, an unusually long tenure as CIO, nearly 16 years. And I wonder, as you reflect upon your tenure since 2001,
the advantages of having had such a long tenure. I don't imagine that as you took on the role in 2001 that you would necessarily anticipate or be presumptuous enough to think you'd still be in role now. But now that it has been a while, no doubt you have created technology that has itself become phased out and replaced by new technology. You've had a chance to really evolve this organization in some fundamental ways, many of which you've already covered, of course. But I'd be interested upon your own reflections on the advantages of such a long tenure.
Having a tenure of this length helps you know both the business and IT environments very deeply to build relationships and to be able to influence from the board of directors down. It helps build a team and a culture and a set of consistent strategies. When I put all of those kinds of things together, I think there's four things that I am pretty proud of that I don't think you could do as a short-tenured CIO, at least not in a large, complex company. The first is these large-scale transformational programs. I have sponsored or co-sponsored quite a number of those, all the way up to the board of directors, worked with this Business Transformation and Technology Committee of the board to try to make sure that we don't embark on these things unless we have the willpower to see them through. And, you know, again, some of these are five-year, $500 million commitments at a time. So I think the ability to help both sponsor or champion and then deliver these large, difficult transformation programs that a lot of companies either don't take on or aren't successful with is one thing. Secondly, to have led the transformation of the IT function itself. When I joined Nationwide, it was decentralized and highly inconsistent. And then we centralized it, and then we've actually gone through a couple of different evolutions to try to get really good at doing the business of IT. And I think both qualitative feedback and quantifiable benchmarks indicate that we have really made very substantial progress to the point of we just recently won a prestigious award for software process achievement and been a leader in lean and agile and virtualization in a lot of areas where when I came in, IT was viewed as an inhibitor to business success. Today, I think we'd be viewed as an enabler. The third is I'm really proud of the team that I've built. And by being here a long time, I've actually been able to mentor and groom leaders through multiple years, multiple different career developmental moves, try to make sure that we have both the right variety of skills and experiences on the leadership team, but also to create a culture of collaboration. And my team works together better than it ever has, but better than any IT leadership team I've ever seen or been a part of. And then probably the fourth thing is being based in our headquarters, city of Columbus, for this many years, I've had a chance to sit in a lot of external boards, both not-for-profit, and then we have even created through a community partnership a for-profit company focused on analytics and cybersecurity to both help the individual companies in the area, but also to support economic development for the region. And I don't think I could probably have been able to have the impact beyond Nationwide that I've been able to have if it had been a short tenure.
Oftentimes, having gotten to know a great number of your peers, they are asked to join a company anew, replacing a leader who the perception may be that the path ahead is sufficiently different from the path paved to this point that it requires new leadership, new thinking, fresh thinking. I'd be curious about how you challenge yourself and your team to ensure that you don't fall in love with the decisions and the technology implemented years ago or even recently. How do you make change part of the core competence when, of course, it's only human nature to resist change?
I could probably argue a little bit the degree to which it's human nature to resist change. It kind of depends on how the change is done. One of my favorite quotes is, people hate change, but they love progress. What I have found with most IT teams, most IT leaders, is they are lifelong learners. They're very open to learn and change. If you create a healthy environment in which it's safe to learn and it's safe to experiment and innovate and you deal with both successes and failures in an appropriate way. But anyway, back to your core question, you know, I try to stay connected. I'm on a number of advisory boards that give me visibility both inside the insurance industry and in the technology industry. So for example, I'm on a McKinsey board that focuses on the insurance industry. I'm on an IBM board of advisors where they bring in CIOs from multiple industries all over the world. So those forums help. I've stayed active in a number of executive development type areas, and you know, we spend time with consultants and thought leaders, and then we continue to try to bring in appropriately outside talent to challenge our thinking. I've been able to attract some very, very bright and capable people and create a culture where we try to stay current with what's going on. We try to have the right debate and create the right kind of environment where we're not stuck in one way of thinking. You know, I think we also have a good commitment as a company to diversity, both in the traditional sense, but also in terms of thought diversity. It is a risk. I completely understand that one of the things that people would worry about with long tenure is that you won't get the new thinking and that people won't be adaptable. I think we've managed to work around that risk. And I think the advantages that I spoke about earlier outweigh yet. I don't know what the right tipping point is, but when I hear average CIO tenures and 3 years, 4 years, and like I said, many of our programs, you couldn't start and finish them in that much time, and especially if you spent the first year of that cycle learning or whatever. So I think it has been an advantage to us. And you know, most of the discussion with our CEO and our board is that they want to make sure I'm grooming internal successors. So I think they're happy enough with what we've delivered on and confident enough in my team that they don't feel the need to go outside and change it up.
I'd also be interested for those great leaders who've been direct reports of yours, the fact that you've been the CIO for such a long period of time, are there creative ways you've thought about advancement for them when, in, of course, your role has been spoken for instance, finding opportunities in other parts of the organization? Be curious if there are any interesting methods that you've used to help people in those sorts of situations.
I mean, we put a lot of time and attention into executive development, and you know, we do fairly frequent things like internal rotational development. I've mentioned I've had people on my current direct report team who, in the time I've been here, have had multiple promotions and who have spent time in cybersecurity and infrastructure and application development, and maybe they've done application development in the centralized group that we've created, or maybe they've based off with multiple different internal businesses to learn different businesses and industries within the family, so to speak. We have had some movement between the business and IT, but it's more common that we're doing those moves inside of IT. I can also tell you, I've set a pretty high bar, so some of the folks that wanted to stay weren't able to. Some of the people who didn't see an ability to move as fast or up as high as they wanted to go as fast as they did opted out on their own voluntarily. I think it's been a mix of approaches, but clearly to the greatest degree possible, when we get really good people, try to keep them very happy and continue to grow and develop them internally to the greatest degree possible.
You also referenced among the boards you sit on, Columbus 2020. You're a board member of that private-public partnership that brings together research companies, academic institutions, a variety of companies representing the broad ecosystem in Columbus and the surrounding areas to help in economic development and attract other businesses, presumably also to the area. I'd be interested, as you referenced Columbus, it's been getting a lot of really great press in terms of business friendliness, good place to start a business, good place to pursue a business career. I'd be interested in your own perspectives as to the sort of advantages of Columbus, Ohio, as somebody who's been working there for such a long time.
Take it from a couple of different angles. One, Columbus 2020 is part of a network of regional economic development groups in the state. The state of Ohio, under Governor Kasich, privatized economic development under a group called Jobs Ohio. I think that's been a really good move. All of the regions, I think, have really upped their games in terms of the talent they have to attract businesses into their regions and grow the businesses that are there. Personally, I have the belief that our chief economic officer at Columbus 2020, Kenny McDonald, is one of the best in the country. And we have made, I think, amazing progress on all of the things that we measure ourselves on, whether it's attracting new businesses, growing the number of jobs, increasing the average pay of those jobs, attracting capital investment into the region. And so I think the partnership between the region and the state has been instrumental. You mentioned public-private partnership. We have the Ohio State University here, who's been very actively involved, and it's obviously a very large research and academic institution and has played a big role, as have a lot of other universities and even community colleges. And then the business leadership in Columbus, I think, has some unique characteristics. We have a lot of large companies here that are not competitive with one another, and so the CEOs of those companies work together in a way that I think is pretty unusual. I'll just give you one example. One of the things that I took on as part of my Columbus 2020 group was to pull together the CIOs of the biggest Central Ohio-based companies and look for ways to both help our companies and grow technology jobs in the region. And it took multiple years, so I'm going to give you the very short version of the story. But we ended up creating for-profit company called the Columbus Collaboratory. I chair the board. My peer CIOs are on that board. We've hired a very capable CEO and leadership team and building out advanced capabilities in cybersecurity and analytics. We got money from the private companies as well as a grant from the state. And I think it's very exciting. We're getting better at things like cyber and analytics by working together, but we're also creating intellectual capital and products and services that can be taken to the broader market. I think that's the kind of thing that you would have a hard time doing in a lot of other cities because, you know, you either don't have enough big companies or they don't work well together or they're competitors with one another. And having the diversity of businesses, the partnership both amongst the private sector and between private, public, and academic is, like I said, I think pretty unique and it's made it a lot of fun.
That's excellent. I was also pleased to hear University of Michigan man saying something nice about Ohio State.
Yep. I still love my alma mater. I still cheer for my football season, but yep, the OSU partnership has been great as well.
That's great. I wanted to also ask you, we've mentioned already a number of trends, many of them critical and clearly a number that you're riding to great success. I wonder if there are any others we've not mentioned that are making their way either just as points of curiosity for you or your team or more formally in your strategic roadmap.
I think the trends that we look at are probably very consistent with what you would hear from most CIOs, data and analytics, artificial intelligence, Internet of Things, cloud, mobile, digital, blockchain, and we're kind of watching all of those. For me, where they really get interesting, though, is where they come together in combination and allow real innovation or disruption to happen. And so we pay attention to that, both where we think it's an opportunity and where is it a threat. So just as an example, we are a very large insurer of vehicles. So anything from motorcycles to private automobiles, consumer-owned automobiles, to commercial or business-owned auto, to tractors, to long-haul trucks. Probably a third of our revenue comes from vehicle-related insurance. And if you look at the trends around smart vehicles, vehicles that have new safety features or even semi-autonomous all the way to fully autonomous vehicles, not very far down the road, that's a big change. The cars are connecting like never before. When we first started in areas like telematics, you know, you'd have to put a unique device in the car. Now we're starting to collect that data either through partnerships with the OEMs who are putting modems on board or through things like data that we can get from smartphones. We also have the whole sharing economy with car sharing and ride sharing. And when you put all of those things together, the nature of transportation is changing, you know, pretty significantly. And that will change the nature of risks and what's going to be insured and how it's going to be insured. So it's kind of looking at that holistic set of trends and how they could affect our business that I think gets most interesting. And if we're asking about Columbus, that's another one that's been kind of fun. I, through Columbus 2020, also have joined the executive committee of a group called Smart Columbus. The U.S. Department of Transportation gave Columbus a grant. We won that grant in competition with over 70 other cities to focus on this whole area of smart mobility. And so that same kind of public-private academic partnership that I talked about on the case of the Columbus Collaboratory is also being brought to bear looking at kind of what is the future of mobility, inclusive of how the city, you know, academic researchers, private companies can come together to create higher accessibility, better ability for people to get where they want to go cost-effectively. A lot of exciting work going on in that area as well.
Well, Mike Keller, thank you so much for joining us on the Forum on World Class IT. It's been a great conversation.
Okay, it's a pleasure to meet you. Thank you, Peter.
You've just listened to a podcast in a series we call MetaStrategies Forum on World Class IT. If you like what you've heard, please consider reading my book, World Class IT, Why Businesses Succeed When IT Triumphs, published by Josie Bass, a division of Wiley Press, in December of 2009. Both the book and the Forum on World Class IT offer stories from a wide range of top IT leaders relating to MetaStrategies' five principles of world class IT. The five principles are as follows. Principle one is people, and it's really the foundational principle. Without the right people doing the right jobs at the right time, it'll be nearly impossible to achieve excellent performance. The second principle is infrastructure. We like to say that this is the principle that separates proactive organizations from reactive ones. If infrastructure is not reliably performing its tasks, the IT organization will become stuck in reactive mode, consistently fighting fires. If systems and hardware and networks and so on work reliably, then a larger portion of the organization can think about the future. The third principle is project and portfolio management. This is the engine through which new capabilities can be brought to bear on behalf of the company. It is important to ensure that projects are delivered on time, on budget, and on target, and that the portfolio collectively supports the objectives of the business. The fourth principle is IT and business partnerships. It's important that, first and foremost, the different parts of IT, from business analysis to development and QA, through to support and all other aspects of IT, communicate effectively and efficiently. It's equally important, then, that IT develop a partnering relationship with the business that it is a part of. If the three prior principles are done well, then IT should earn a place at the strategy setting table, driving different parts of the business strategy. The fifth and last principle is external partnerships. Outsourcing is becoming a crucial weapon that organizations are employing, and managing these relationships to ensure that value is achieved is critical. In the fourth principle, the organization has learned and contributed to the discussion about what is strategic and what is not. Once that's clear, then it will be easier to determine which aspects of IT might be better managed by external partners or vendors. For more information on these five principles and the sub-principles that are associated with each, please visit our website at www.metastrategy.com, and please share your thoughts and comments by contacting us at feedback@metastrategy.com. And our theme music was written by David Armin. I'm Peter High. Thanks for listening.